pretend I wasn't missing you too. WMFO Medford. Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there is no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. A couple of programming notes. I got a student DJ for training this morning. I'm going to play one Western. It's one I've played before. Finding the right buttons. To Gunsmoke. I played it before, probably at the end of last spring or last winter. Its original air date was the 5th of February, 1956, and it's called Legal Revenge. This is Arthur, and you're listening to The Grand Hour on WMFO Medford.
City and in the territory on West, there's just one way to handle the killers and the spoilers, and that's with a U.S. Marshal and the smell of gun smoke. Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The transcribed story of the violence that moved west with young America. And the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, and it makes a man watchful. And a little lonely.
Sam?
Kitty, what do you have?
I'm going out to Delmonico's for something to eat. If Marshal Dillon comes in, tell him to wait, will you?
I'll send him on to Delmonico's.
No, he's to wait here. It's Doc who's trying to find him.
Oh.
You look tired, Sam.
I ought to. I've been tending bar for 12 hours steady.
Well, what happened to the help you hired last night?
You had the wrong idea, Kitty.
Huh?
I'm in business to sell whiskey, not give it away to anybody who needs a drink and can't pay for it.
Is that what he was doing?
It was till I caught him at it.
Hello, Kitty. Sam.
Oh, Marshal.
Matt, you're to stay right here at the bar.
What?
I promised Doc if you came in, I'd keep you here. He's been looking all over town for you.
Well, I thought Doc was delivering a baby down on Salt Creek.
Well, he got back about a half hour ago.
Oh, what does he want me for?
It's about some trouble with a man and his wife called Tebbs.
Tebbs?
Well, not where he delivered the baby. This was in a sod hut about a mile above the crossing.
Ah, well, what about him?
Here he comes. He'll tell you. Here he is, Doc.
Oh, fine. So you're a good girl, Kitty. Yes, you are. You're a good girl. I might never have found him.
What's all this about these Tebbs people, Doc?
Well, they're having trouble, Matt.
Oh, what kind of trouble?
Well, I stopped by to say hello and get acquainted, and... Well, you know.
Oh, sure.
But the woman, she didn't act like she wanted anybody around. And then I heard the man yell at me from inside. She tried to stop me, but I went in anyways. He was lying there on the bed, Matt, with a bad knife wound in his leg.
Oh?
Yes. It's festered and it's given him a fever, and I don't think he can walk with it.
Did he say what happened?
Well, he claimed it was an accident, but he was holding a six-gun under that blanket, Matt.
Well, what for?
For his wife. He's scared to death of her. I think she knifed him, and I think she's waiting for a chance to finish him off. You better get down there, Matt. Maybe too late already.
Reckon this the Tab's place, all right, Mr. Dillon?
That's the way Doc described it, all right, Chester? Including the wife out there hoeing in the dirt.
She's letting on she don't see us.
Yeah. I didn't expect we'd be very welcome here.
Just wait till she finds out you're a marshal.
And I'm not gonna tell her, Chester. Not right off, anyway. Hello, ma'am.
Hello.
We were looking for a drink of water.
Creek's over yonder.
Yeah, but you got a well here.
Water's no better than the creek.
Okay, we'll use the creek. But, first I'd like to talk to your husband.
My husband? What about?
Wanted to get acquainted.
He ain't here.
Ah. Well, we go get a drink, then we'll come back and wait for it.
No.
Who are you talking to, Florrie? Who's out there?
Nobody. Now you stay quiet. He's feeling poorly, mister. I don't want nobody bothering him.
Well, we won't bother him.
You stay out of there. Well, then I'm coming, too.
You better wait outside, Justin.
Yes, sir. That hut can't hold more than three people anyway.
Hello.
I knew I heard somebody.
Your wife says that you're sick, Tibbs.
I told you to leave him alone. I told you not to be troubling him.
Well, I'm only being neighborly, ma'am. If he's sick, maybe I can help.
So you're a neighbor, mister?
Well, my partner and I are planning a homestead nearby. As soon as we can decide on a good piece of land.
Oh, you get it staked out, then you come see us, mister. Everything will be fine then.
Florrie, don't be that way. Me being sick and her having to do all the chores makes her kind of edgy, mister. And being up nights, it's what's hardest on her.
I ain't complaining.
Yeah, I know, Florrie, but I can tell. Mister, I got an idea. Said you wanted to help.
Sure, anything I can do.
Be willing to sit up with me tonight?
No, Ben.
You need some rest, Florrie. You see, I got a fever, mister. I get to tossing in my sleep. I throw off a blanket, all like that.
You don't look like you've been sleeping at all.
Will you do it, mister? Sit up with me?
No. No, he ain't gonna sit up with you.
Oh, why not, ma'am? I don't mind.
Because I ain't gonna sleep in here with no stranger about, that's why.
Oh.
Well, I didn't think she would.
Look, I'll tell you what. I'll spend the night on the ground outside, if you don't mind.
We do mind.
Florrie, you ain't acting like a wife. You ain't acting like a wife at all.
You can stay, mister.
No, fine, good.
Wait a minute, mister.
Yeah, what?
I was just wondering if maybe tomorrow, if you'd be willing... I ought to get into Dodge and see the doc. There's a wagon outside.
No, you don't.
Oh, shut up.
Well, sure, we'll take you in, mister. We'll be glad to.
Are you really going to drive him into Dodge tomorrow, Mr. Dillon?
Yeah, we better.
Well, why don't she want him to go?
Well, I guess Doc was right, Chester. She put a knife in him, and now she's trying to finish him off.
Well, if he's got a six gun under his blanket, why don't he just shoot her?
Then who'd take care of him, feed him? He's getting more fever every day, and he can hardly walk anyway.
Well, it sure can't last much longer with him staying awake, trying to keep an eye on her all the time.
Yeah. Chester, I think I'm going to go in there and tell him who I am and load him into a wagon tonight. This has gone on long enough.
I reckon you better, Mr. Dillon.
Yeah. Where's your wife?
She went around back, mister.
Look, Tebbs.
Hmm?
I'm going to take you into Dodge tonight.
You are? Oh, that'll be fine. Oh, except for Flory.
You want to tell me what's going on here?
What do you mean?
I'm not a homesteader, Tebbs. I'm a U.S. Marshal.
Huh?
That's right. And I'm going to take you into Dodge, Flory or no Flory. You need sleep and you need care.
Oh, well...
Now, you can tell me your story when you want to.
No, Oh, no story. I just got hurt a little, is all. Here, look here, Marshal. You gotta understand, Flory. She don't mean what she says. She gets all riled up over nothing. You know how women are.
What are you trying to say, Tebbs?
Well, I'm fine right here. And Flory... Yeah, she's a good nurse, Marshal.
You mean you don't want to go to Dodge?
Oh, shucks, I'll be up and around in a couple of days. Don't you worry about me.
All right. But I'll be back. Chester. Chester.
Get your hands up and turn around, Marshal.
She's got a shotgun, Mr. Dillon.
And I'll use it, too.
She was listening at the window.
Now my hands are up, Flory.
I'm taking your gun.
She got my gun, too, Mr. Dillon.
You're making a bad mistake, Flory.
I won't have you nor nobody else meddling where you don't belong. Now get your horses and ride out of here.
All right. But we'll be back.
I'm going to be sitting right by that door, Marshal. First thing I see or hear gets a load of buckshot.
It won't be us, Flory. But we'll be close enough to hear if you do shoot somebody.
I couldn't help it, Mr. Dillon. She come ooching around the side of the hut, and I didn't even see that cussed shotgun till it was too late.
Yeah, neither did I.
What are we gonna do?
There's nothing we can do tonight. But tomorrow, in the daylight... Now we got our rifles. We'll think up some tricks for her.
See her on the horse, Mr. Dillon.
She must be inside the hut, Chester.
Well, I hope she don't come charging out of there with that shotgun blazing.
That would be a bad way to start the day, wouldn't it?
I can't think of none worse.
especially on an empty stomach.
Now, there she is.
Hmm?
Now, wait a minute. It's all right. She isn't armed.
Come on over here, Marshal.
Now, what's she up to?
Yeah, it's hard to say with a woman like that.
I thought you'd be back this morning.
Yes, and I told you we would. We're going to take your husband into Dodge, ma'am.
You're too late, Marshal.
Too late?
He died during the night.
What?
It was too much for his heart. He always did have a weak heart.
Where is he, Florrie?
Lying there inside, Marshal. Why? Don't you believe me?
I believe you, but I want to have a look at him.
What for? I got him all wrapped up in his blanket, ready for burying. You'll go dig a grave for him if you want to help so much.
All right, we'll dig a grave after I've seen him.
You got no respect for the dead, Marshal?
It's the living that bothers me right now, Florrie. I'm going to have a look at him now, Florrie.
You're no better than a coyote, Marshal.
You don't have to watch.
Oh, go ahead. I don't care.
I'll unbutton his shirt here. All right, what did you use, Florrie?
Use? For what?
I might have known he couldn't stay awake forever. He fell asleep and you stabbed him in the heart with a needle or something. That doesn't show much, does it?
All right, I'll tell you. Don't matter none anyway. I killed him.
Why would you want to kill your husband, Florrie?
My husband. He wasn't my husband. He killed my husband, Marshal. We never seen him before. He rode by here and started trouble. Over me it was. And my husband pulled a knife, but he shot him. And I swore I'd kill him for it, and I did.
Why didn't you explain all this to Doc Adams when he was out here? Or to me last night?
And let you take him and hang him? I had to kill him myself, Marshal. It's a promise I made my husband while he was dying.
And I'm going to have to arrest you.
You can't do nothing to me for this.
You murdered a man, Florrie.
You're wrong, Marshal.
You just admitted it.
Well, I ain't doing no more talking. You take care of him and we'll go into Dodge. But I won't be in jail long, you'll see.
Good morning, Chester.
Good morning, Mr. Dillon. What you got there?
That's a mail.
Oh, did you pick it up?
Yeah, I picked it up. I was down there anyway. How's Florrie?
She ain't said a word.
Go get her, will you?
What for?
She was right, Chester. I can't keep her in jail.
But, Mr. Dillon, we just
Go
can't
get
all
her,
offer
will you.
Yes, sir. Come on out, Florrie.
You turning me loose?
Not me. Mr. Dillon is.
It's about time.
Morning, Florrie.
Not much of a jail you got, Marshal.
Well, it's not strong enough to hold you.
Of course it ain't.
Florrie, the man you killed, you told me you've never seen him before, huh?
I never had.
What was his name?
George Bassett.
What else did you know about him?
He was wanted, dead or alive.
He was wanted?
I got a circular on him in the mail, Chester. It's there on my desk.
A circular? Well, forevermore.
How did you know he was wanted, Florrie?
He said so.
Now, that's hard to believe.
Now, he told me when he was bothering me before he killed my husband. He said one more wouldn't matter. I guess he planned to kill me, too, later. Only he hadn't figured on getting cut up, and he needed me after that.
Yeah. Now, why didn't you tell me this out there, Florrie?
I didn't think you'd believe me, Marshal.
Well, maybe you were right. I never heard of George Bassett before.
You heard of him now?
Yeah. There's going to be some reward money coming, Flory.
Marshal?
Yeah, what?
You say it.
Say what, Flory? Oh,
please.
How? That you don't want the money? That you wouldn't take it?
Thank you, Marshal. Thank you for saying it right. I feel some cleaner for that. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Flory.
Produced and directed by Norman McDonald, stars William Conrad as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal. Our story was specially written for Gunsmoke by John Meston, with music composed and conducted by Rex Corey. Sound patterns by Tom Hanley and Bill James. Harley Bear is Chester and Georgia Ellis is Kitty.
Legal Revenge. At an original air date of the 5th of February, 1956. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and we're going to have a public service announcement from Roth.
Every week during the academic year, the Tufts Environmental Studies Lunch and Learn Lecture Series brings a speaker from the government, industry, academia, or nonprofit organization to campus to give a presentation on a timely environmental topic. Free vegetarian pizza is provided to those who arrive early. All Lunch and Learn talks are open to the public and take place on Thursdays at noon on the first floor of Curtis Hall Multipurpose Room, formerly Brownenburg. 419 Boston Avenue on Tufts Medford Somerville campus. For more information, including how to watch the talk live online or access the archive afterwards, just search the web for Tufts Lunch and Learn.
Thank you, Roth. I took you off air now. Next, I'm going to play something I played a couple weeks ago on an auxiliary show I did. Because War of the Worlds, this is the 80th year of War of the Worlds broadcast. It was an interesting interview between Orson Welles and H.G. Wells that took place on the 28th of October, 1940. I forget where at in San Antonio, but I will let you know when we're back on the air here. Well, for talking anyway. This is Arthur. You're listening to The Grand Hour on 91.5 FM WMFO and or WMFO.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Charles C. Shaw speaking. KTSA is honored this evening by the presence in our studios of two great men, the Honorable H.G. Wells, world-famous British historian, author, and student of world affairs, and Mr. Orson Welles, the genius of stage, screen, and radio. This is the first time that Mr. H.G. Wells and Mr. Orson Welles have appeared together. In fact, they met for the first time only yesterday here in San Antonio. But this is not the first time that their names have been linked. 2 years ago, Mr. Orson Welles adapted Mr. H.G. Wells' book, War of the Worlds, for radio purposes. And you know the rest. Revising the story somewhat, Mr. Orson Welles depicted an invasion of the United States by men from Mars. Although he explained it numerous times during the program that it was fictitious, the country at large was frightened almost out of its wits. Men called radio stations offering to enlist against the Martians. Others were panic-stricken. The realism of the production, frightening though it was a tribute to Mr. Orson Welles' genius. And thus the name of Welles, H-G-W-E-L-L-S and Orson W-E-L-L-E-S, became linked. Mr. H.G. Wells, in the opinion of many, is the world's most famous man of letters. He has come to San Antonio to address the United States Brewers Association, and Mr. Orson Welles is here for a town hall forum address Wednesday. In this meeting of great minds, I feel rather inconspicuous, and the less I have to say, the better you listeners will like it. But first, could I interest you gentlemen in a discussion of Mr. Orson Welles' broadcast of Mr. H.G. Wells' book, The War of the Worlds?
Are you turning the meeting over to us, sir?
I am, for the moment.
He's turning it over to us. Well, I've had a series of the most delightful experiences since I came to America. But the best thing that has happened so far is meeting my little namesake here, Orson. I find him the most delightful carrier. He carries my name and an extra E that I hope he'll drop sooner or later. See no sense in it. And I've known his work before he made this sensational Halloween spree. Are you sure there was such a panic in America, or wasn't it your Halloween fun?
I think that's the nicest thing that a man from England could possibly say about the men from Mars. Well, because Mr. Hitler made a good deal of sport of it, you know, and actually spoke of it in the Great Munich speech, you know. And there were floats in Nazi parades.
Much else to say.
That's right. Much else to say. And it's supposed to show the corrupt condition and decadent state of affairs in democracies that the War of the Worlds went over as well as it did. I think it's very nice of Mr. Wells to say that not only I didn't mean it, but the American people didn't mean it.
That was our impression in England. We had articles about it, and people said, have you never heard of Halloween in America when everybody pretends to see ghosts?
Well, there was some excitement caused. I really can't belittle the amount that was caused, but I think that the people got over it very quickly, don't you?
What kind of excitement? Mr. H.G. Wells wants to know if the excitement wasn't the same kind of excitement that we extract from a practical joke in which somebody puts a sheet over his head and says, boo, I don't think anybody believes that that individual is a ghost, but we do scream and yell and rush down the hall. Mm-hmm. And that's just about what happened.
That's a very excellent description.
You aren't quite serious in America yet. You haven't got the war right under your chins, and the consequence is you can still play with ideas of terror and conflict.
You think that's good or bad?
It's a natural thing to do until you're right up against it.
So it ceases to be a game.
And then it ceases to be a game.
Well, now, here's a thought. Some of Mr. H.G. Wells' writings are termed fantastic, and a few years ago, well might they have been conceived such. The Shape of Things to Come, which told of a long internecine war, was such a fantasy. But Mr. Orson Welles, do you think that it's so fantastic in view of today's events?
It certainly is not so fantastic. And the one question that Mr. Wells has spoken of, not only in The Shape of Things to Come, but has hinted at or directly prophesied such a state of affairs following a wasting war and a return to a feudalism from which the world would find itself again. And today in Mr. Wells' lecture, he said quite the most interesting thing that I've heard in a long time. He said that he'd commenced just recently to ask himself if there was any reason why mankind should so emulate the phoenix and should so get itself out of its mess. He proposed a couple of solutions, but he did admit that there was a possible excuse for a gloomy point of view, and that it would be good to be realistic about it and not to dismiss the gloomy point of view anymore. Perhaps the time had come to look ahead, since the future, Mr. Wells's future, which we've always adored and never really understood, is suddenly upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are living right now in that famous H.G. Wells future, which we all knew about.
Now, before we get away from this microphone, tell me about this film of yours that you've been producing. You're a producer, aren't you? You're
That's right.
Art director, you're everything.
Well, Mr. Wells...
What's the film called?
It's called Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, yes. Not C-A-I-N.
No, K-A-N-E. And this Kane. Is, of course, the kindest and most gracious possible thing to do. Mr. Wells is making it possible for me to do what in America is spoken of as a plug. And he understands the fine old American
I don't understand these words, yes.
Yes. You understand the value, however. Mr. Wells wants me to tell you that I have made a motion picture, and he is kind enough to ask me a leading question concerning it.
I am looking forward to it.
You're very kind, sir. It's a new sort of motion picture with a new method of presentation and a few new technical experiments, a few new methods of telling a picture, not only from the point of view of writing, but of showing it.
If I don't misunderstand you completely, I think there'll be a lot of jolly good new noises in it.
I hope so. And a few jolly good new noises are what the motion pictures could well afford these days. I hope you're right, and I hope there are some jolly good new noises. I can think of nothing more desirable in motion picture. I'm all for some jolly good.
Okay, that was Orson Welles and H.G. Wells speaking at KTSA in San Antonio on the 28th of October, 1940, kind of in preparation of War of the Worlds, which my brother-in-law indicated, how the heck do you have a radio drama program show without playing War of the Worlds? But I heard something, I've been reading about it, several sources. It kind of gets annoying after a while reading about that broadcast. But Orson Welles played a recording of Herbert Morrison's radio reports of the Hindenburg disaster for actor Frank Reddick and the rest of the cast of the Mercury Theater to demonstrate the mood he wanted. He said later of the broadcast that he wanted people to understand that they shouldn't take any opinion pre-digested, and they shouldn't swallow everything that came through the tap, whether it was radio or not. Arthur is citing an article written by Martin Chilton and published in The Telegraph on the 6th of May, 2016. Kind of more of the interesting articles I've read regarding it. And maybe that's old J.P. Kendall. Part of that, it was a British publication writing about an American radio drama. That being said, I'm going to sign off with the Hindenburg broadcast, and then you will have Roth following me. Thank you. This is Arthur, the Grand Hour. Next week, we'll have alternate programming as well while we're completing Roth's training. If you have any questions, you can submit them to the fan club PO address that, if you're a devout listener, you should know. Thanks for listening.
That they never had before.
Sounds and voices we heard were filled out by our own imaginations to create mental pictures more vivid than anything that television can show us. In 1937, Herbert Morrison of station WLS Chicago was in Lakehurst, New Jersey on a seemingly routine assignment describing the arrival of the German dirigible Hindenburg after its third transatlantic crossing. It turned into one of the most memorable moments in radio.
The Hindenburg left Frankfurt, Germany, Tuesday evening, rather, at 7:30 their time. And for better than 2.5 days, they've been speeding through the skies over miles and miles of water here to America. Now they're coming in to make a landing of the Zeppelin. I'm going to step out here and cover it from the outside. So as I move out, we'll just stand by a second. Well, here it comes, ladies and gentlemen. We're out now outside of the hangar, and what a great sight it is. A thrilling one. It's a marvelous sight. It's coming down out of the sky, pointed directly towards us and toward the mooring mast. The mighty diesel motors just roared, their propellers sliding into the air and throwing it back into a gale-like whirlpool. No wonder this great floating palace can travel through the air at such a speed with these powerful motors behind it. The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding as though it was mighty proud of the place it's playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt busting with activities we can see. Orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers are probably lining the windows, looking down at the field ahead of them, getting their glimpse of the mooring mast. It's starting to rain again. The rain had slacked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It burst into flames. Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring mast. And all the folks agree that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. Oh, the humanity.
But even reality on radio had its lighter side. We heard voices, all kinds of voices. Sometimes they gave an unexpected insight on a public figure. When Charles Lindbergh made his solo flight across the Atlantic in May 1927, he seemed to be as stoic and short-spoken as a guest.
Are you happy?
And now, by Arthur's infinite grace, we interrupt the grand hour for a special demo recording of Ralph von Dorneil, where we explore the opus of one particular band in no particular order. That particular band is and always will be the Mountain Goats, cult indie folk rock group composed of John Darnielle and all those with whom he happens to surround himself. We'll be working our way from song to song via the most long-winded segues this side of Macon County line. Because with Mountain Goats, whether it's the music, the listener, or the man himself, someone is going to be telling a story about something. And if it's a story, then where to start? We could start where John started, in which case I might play, dance music, tableau of his early childhood home in California. We could start where the Mountain Goats started, might play Alpha Incipient's first track off Zopilot Machine, earliest commercially available album. We could start with The Idea of Starting, in which case I might play San Bernardino, a song about birth. But this show isn't about any of those things. It super is, but also not really. And it can't be. Because like any other interpretive work, this is about the author. Which in this case is me, because I have a mic. If you want to be the author, you can call in, but you don't have a mic. So, I figured there was no better way to begin this inherently narcissistic exercise than by going through a few of the songs that mark important moments in the formation of my relationship with this music. We're going to begin where many do, with the 2005 album The Sunset Tree, one of the band's breakouts. It was actually the third of a free album contract with 4AD, and Darnielle was preparing for it to be his last. He was leaving it all out on the field with this one. That heart has got to be what makes it such a popular on-ramp for new listeners. The Sunset Tree is a musical memoir. Darnielle tells of his early life under an abusive stepfather, the beginnings of a downward spiral that would follow. For as long as I've been listening to and thinking about this album, it wasn't until writing for this show that I forced myself to break the mystique of this particular song. It was the first I ever heard back in 2013. I wanted it to remain beautiful nonsense, something separate from the rest of the body of work, the fascinating but not necessarily transcendent, you know, readily dissected words telling a story set to music. But one of the truths about art that we're all told, but took me an unreasonably long amount of time to believe, is that it is both possible and pleasurable to switch back and forth between those two modes. Says Darnielle about this song, "We are fairly well damaged by the legacy of the romantic poets, that we think of love as this thing that is accompanied by strings and is a force for good, and that if something bad comes from it, then that's not love. And the therapeutic tradition that I come from, I used to work in therapy, also says that it's not love if it feels bad. And I don't know so much about that. I don't know that the Greeks weren't right. I think they were, that love can eat a path through everything, that it will destroy a lot of things on the way to its own objective, which is just its expression of itself. My stepfather loved his family, right? He mistreated us terribly quite often, but he loved us. And you know, well, that is, to me, something worth commenting on in the hopes of undoing a lot of what I perceive as terrible damage in the way people talk about this. Love as this benign, comfortable force. It's not that. It's wild." This is Love, Love, Love by the Mountain Goats.
Saul fell on his sword when it all went wrong, and Joseph's brothers sold him down the river for a song. And Sonny Liston rubbed some tiger balm into his glove. Some things you do for money, and some you do for love, love, love. Thank you. sick, but he couldn't say why. When he saw his face reflected in his victim's twinkling eye. Some things you'll do for money, and some you'll do for fun. But the things you do for love are gonna come back to you one by one. Love, love is gonna lead you by the hand. Into a wide and soundless place. Now we see things as in a mirror dimly. Then we shall see each other face to face. And way out in Seattle, young Kurt Cobain snuck out to the greenhouse, put a bullet in his brain. Snakes in the grass beneath our feet, rain in the clouds above. Some moments last forever, but some flare out with love, love, love.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active. Another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes. Another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger. Two if you're very overweight. And three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Boy, do I wish I'd chosen a more relevant PSA. Because the next couple of songs I got are about high school. It's weird. I'm a freshman. It's college, it's October, barely been a month. End up reflecting a lot on high school. A lot of how I understand the world right now, how I think about the art I'm presented with, ties back to high school. Ties into change, liminality, mostly for lack of any other prior experiences. And talking about that stuff on a college campus, people only a couple years older than you who are nominally adults, and look, probably don't feel, but look, ready to enter broader society, it inspires some hesitation, but also, hey, who's listening? I heard this next song immediately after Love, 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 and for about 3 years, it was really the only Mountain Goat song I kept in rotation. It's where a lot of people's knowledge of the band begins and ends. Can't blame them, it's a bop. Gained some new personal significance when I very deliberately used it to bookend my senior year of high school, set out to play it on the first and last day of a period in my life about which I remained very undecided. It's about hard times. It's about the acts of self-destruction they inspire. It's about this really pernicious thing where sometimes in your head something convinces you that it's that self-destructive behavior that's making you feel better instead of a company that that misery loves. That company is actually what's going to save you. This is This Year by the Mountain Goats. All right. We're going to finish up this hour with a song that was written about someone who's fine now. Probably never needed anyone else to hope that they'd be fine, but the song got written. The song got listened to. Hopefully it got appreciated. It was never officially released. This is a recording from a live performance. This is Thought You Were Cool by the Mountain Goats.
Something on my mind, and I don't want to squander the moment trying to come up with a better way to say what I want to say. People were mean to you, but I always thought you were cool. Clicking down the concrete hallways in your spiked heels back in high school. Side, with our hearts still beating, having stared down demons, come back breathing. People were mean to you, but I always thought you were cool. Clicking down the concrete hallways in your spiked heels back in high school. You deserved better than you got. Someone's gotta say it sometime, 'cause it's true. People should have told you you were awesome instead of taking advantage of you. I hope you love your life now like I love mine. I hope the painful memories only flex their power over you a little of the time. We held on to hope of better days coming, and when we did, we were right. I hope the people who did you wrong have trouble sleeping. People were mean to you, but I always thought you were cool. Clicking down the concrete hallways in your spiked heels back in high school. Thank you very much.
All right, that's all we've got time for today. Wake Up Sleepyhead is next with Marco here on WMFO Medford. The things that you've got coming will do things that you're afraid to. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Shadows fall and shift.